Sorry. We have to discuss.
It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
I'm here. Johnny, are you there? Good morning, guys.
Oh,
we're here.
Fantastic. How are you, John and Laurie? Good morning.
We're in different parts of the house, and so we're both here right now, and that's what matters. How are you, Hezzy?
Thank God. Okay. I'm so excited to talk to you today because I happen to love this Hyundai Kona vehicle. I think it's the greatest thing I've seen in a long time.
This is the perfect car for anybody and everybody. It really, it was a delight to test this week. It really was.
Yeah. We actually got to drive it a lot because they brought it on Wednesday and they're not picking it up until today.
But,
so we actually had a...
But the thing is, we wanted to drive it. I mean, there's certain cars that were not... That we're not excited to drive, but it's not because the cars are not exciting. It's because the cars don't suit our lifestyle.
Right.
This Kona, this Hyundai, once again, I mean, I feel like Johnny and I are the biggest cheerleaders for a Hyundai on the planet. But once again, Hyundai is knocked off the socks with this compact SUV. It is phenomenally.
It's a North American.
Car of the year?
Well, subcon the North American subcompact
car
of the year. Big deal.
Wow. This Hezzy, you would love this in Manhattan, in the tri-boroughs.
Oh, absolutely.
We loved it here in Pinehurst.
Perfect.
This is a car we would easily take on a long road trip. This is a car that would fit into any parking space in New York City. It just hits all the bells and whistles.
Is it really good? Is it? Because I was wondering if it's really good for a long trip. I mean, is it good support in the legs and the seating?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I thought it was terribly comfortable and roomy, and that's partially because proportionally the height of the car, which is proportionate to the wheelbase width, makes it look like a bigger car inside and outside. It's not really it's a compact car, but. It's designed so well.
It's smaller than my Edge.
Yes, it is.
Significantly smaller than my Edge, but it doesn't necessarily feel that way. And I think it's probably, some of it has to do with the width, because it doesn't have a long wheelbase, but it does have the right width. Mm-hmm. And so the ride's actually pretty good. Would I take it on a long trip? Yeah, I'd prefer maybe other ones, but certainly for buzzing around town or for anything within 2 hours, I think it's probably fine.
And yet I would take it on a long trip, and here's what, I'm sorry, go ahead. I would take it on a long trip, and here's why. It was easy to drive. It was solid, as all Hyundais to me are, solid to drive, a responsive, tremendous gas mileage. The thing I like about it for anybody is it would be great for Johnny and me. It would be great for a family of four where two children could easily sit in the back seat with child restraints or child car seats.
And you still have enough room in the back end to put a couple of stuff.
The question I've got to ask you then is, how do you choose between all your grandchildren? You know,
We'd have to get four high-end Iconas, but or a really big roof rack or some kind of a drag some.
Right.
Kind
yeah, we'll
of trailer.
Put the ones that we don't like on the roof. So.
We love them all.
Okay.
But
spoken like a grandmother.
Yeah, exactly. But so great young family car, great retired people's car, great all around car, city, suburb, country. Town, village, anywhere.
Okay.
Now, as an off-road vehicle, I don't think Wynn is with us today because he's gotten some kind of a chest cold. But
okay.
And he's got five children.
Yeah, but not an off-road car per se, but it's going to take you places. Johnny, why don't you go into the specs on the car?
Well, the first thing that, of course, I always say about Hyundais is the safety aspect of it. They're the first ones that came out with the commercial where the guys jump out of a Hyundai onto a flatbed truck and the cars all follow one another down the road. I remember that forever.
Johnny, I just want to say one to interrupt you here. We mentioned that commercial, not just with Hyundai, but almost with every car that we speak about with regard to safety measures. Because it was such impact when we saw. I don't mean.
And they were the first ones. They were the first ones that did anything like that.
It was so. It was such an eye opener. So
that leads into what I was going to say, which is all of the features that we talked about, like safety and all those kinds of everything about this car, are now all standard features. You don't pay any. There is no add-on. The only add-on feature. Listen to this. Was carpeted floor mats for $125. That was the only add-on to the whole thing. And the total package, just like it is $30,000. And it's worth, I don't know, it's worth $10,000 just in safety, just in the safety knowledge, just to know that you have things that are going to help you stay out of an accident or protect you if you are in one. But mostly, I think, to stay out of one. Because this, you know, the safety features on this one that are included, all included, the forward collision avoidance assist with pedestrian detection, that's the stopping, you know, what happens, you're not paying attention, stops itself. Lane keep assist, driver attention warning, blind spot, rear cross traffic collision warning, and I love the cameras, which are now about 180 degrees. So when you start to back up, you look in the image, and it shows the traffic in both directions. So it's not just behind you; it's also to your side. You can actually see people coming. Four-wheel disc brake. Well, that's normal. Four-wheel disc brakes. Parking distance warning reverse. So it not only can you see when you're backing up, you're looking at the cars, but it also gives you a warning when you're getting close, and it uses the yellow, red markers. Then it also has an alert when you're getting too close. I think and that's on a lot of them these days. But again, Hyundai was the first to see these front side curtain airbags. Rollover sensors, and of course tire pressure monitoring for those kinds of things. But that's all standard stuff now, you know. And it is and it's not a big vehicle, but it has all those features. Another thing that they've done, which I really like, ours is the ultimate all-wheel drive. Okay, and it has a 1.6 liter turbocharged GDI four-cylinder engine. Now, the one thing I loved about this, and some of the other ones I've driven, and we've talked about this before, it's like four chipmunks are in there, and you got to, get the whip out to get them to go. Right, but there's no delay on this. There's virtually no delay. 175 horsepower, 195 pounds of foot torque, 7-speed eco shift, dual clutch transmission, and, of course, the thing I judge them by is because we have circles here, you have to get in the queue to go around the circle. And and most people, hopefully, know that if you come to a stop and then have to enter into the circle, it's more difficult to get your vehicle going from a stopped position, sort of the law of physics. Things in motion tends to stay in motion, it rests, stays at rest. So, if you ease up toward the toward your entry point, even if you're only doing 2, 3, 4 miles an hour, you have momentum, and so it's much easier to flow into the traffic. You don't have to wait for a big long space for you to get in. You can judge, the speed of the vehicles and so forth, and move in. And they should be doing about 30 miles an hour. That's kind of the normal thing. But the thing I loved about this car is it was immediately responsive. Whether you were going slow or you had to stop and wait for people to go by, the response time was really quick. It really had a nice little jump to it. It got you into traffic. It was easy to move. Lori was talking about the driving capability. It had very good handling qualities, easy to move between the lanes, easy to focus. You really felt the car was responsive. I liked all those things about it.
I got to ask you a question, because one of the big issues that you always bring up is, well, actually, it's Lori. Evidently, you guys only fight when you're in the car. So when Lori was driving, did you give her a hard time? Or when she was driving, when you were driving, she gave you a hard time? Or is the Hyundai Kona Ultimate was so engaging that you didn't have time for that?
No, it was a great week. I don't think I hardly ever drove anywhere with her, and she didn't drive anywhere with me. It was a wonderful week.
Oh, that's how you resolved it.
Yeah,
I love it.
Great. No problem.
Yeah, the best driving conversations we have start with, "Honey, I'm going now. I'll see you when I get back." So, yeah, it works great.
Yeah. Always
that is fantastic. And what about the all-wheel drive? How does that affect the vehicle?
It just keeps – you just have this feeling of being really solid wherever you turn, really engaged with your driving.
Actually, let me just say something to that. Actually, all-wheel drive on a vehicle that's this size, I don't think you notice it, which is actually a very positive thing. You don't notice any difference. And like Lori was saying – I'll let you go back and say it – but the solidness, the feeling that you are connected to the road is certainly there. Go ahead, honey.
Nice.
Yeah, and responsive, because, you know, basically you've got all four wheels, you know, cooking. And,
right.
And that contributes, I'm sure, to the feel of the wheel, because even though you don't feel that you're, you know, manipulating all four wheels, there's something to be said about a front-wheel drive car versus the all-wheel drive car, in that there's sometimes give to the steering wheel when you're driving. You can feel you know, either too much or too little that, you know, you're in control of your cars.
I had an old Lincoln. You remember the old Lincolns that looked like, we call them land yachts, the great big rectangular ones? And we used to talk about, you swam down the road because, you know, you turn the wheel, and in, I don't know, second or two, the car starts turning. It's like driving a yacht sort of a thing. But, yeah, Lori's right. This one was just – the responsiveness on this one was – it was like a sports car. It was like some sports car. Yeah, really good.
The thing is, we never had any adverse weather conditions. We haven't had rain in a while. We had no adverse weather conditions or wind to see how
we had heat. The air conditioning works great.
Yeah, very instant. The air conditioning comes right on. But so we really can't speak to that, what it would have been if we had some icy road conditions or some torrential rain. So we can't speak to that part of our review because we didn't have it. But one thing that I can say is that I have no doubt, because it's a Hyundai, that it would respond beautifully in adverse weather conditions. It's just part of that family of cars that's so dependable. Again, I'm getting out my pom-poms and cheerleading hat. Hyundai is so responsible and so respected for, as Johnny says, its real insight into the driver's needs, the safety measures, all that good stuff.
Well, while you're – hey, stand on the sidelines and wave your pom-poms. Let me tell you why – and let's get back to the game, and I'll tell you.
Oh, are you so cute?
What's going on? That was a good one.
Hit a – not hit a – what's it – what's – you some,
scored a touchdown.
Scored a touchdown. Okay, you go. You go, guys.
Missing my football, I can tell you that. In this – actually, the inland freight and handling on this car was $1,000. So the real cost of the car itself with a full tank of gas – you know, why would you point that out? Do you remember back when you used to buy cars and they would give you a tank of gas and tell you what – how – that was what they were throwing in. Do you remember that?
Right.
I do.
Yeah.
This one, the standard feature is a full tank of gas, so they fill it up for you to start with. Anyway, if you take out the shipping and handling, it's $29,000. Well, what do you get in addition to all these wonderful safety features? And we talked about the powertrain and all that. What do you get besides that? Well, you get 18-inch alloy wheels. You get a tire mobility kit in lieu of a fire in lieu of a spare tire. Not sure exactly what a mobility kit is, but you get the automatic on and off headlights and LED daytime running lights. Another safety feature, by the way. Fog lights, which are LED. LED headlights and tail lights. You get the shark fin antenna.
Well, honey, just wait a minute. And those lights really do make a difference.
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
They make a huge difference, those LED lights.
Yeah. At night, it's very much brighter, very, much better. You get rain-sensing windshield wipers, plus a rear wiper washer. No, I'm not. Rain-sensing windshield wiper, which I think is really cool. Power door locks and windows with front auto down and up. Heated side mirrors with turn signal indicators, proximity key with key push button, so you don't need a key, auto temperature control, 8-way power driver seat plus power lumbar, heated front seats, 60-40 split folding rear seat with a center armrest, leather seating surfaces, with, including the steering wheel. No, leather steering wheel, leather and leather shift knob, auto dimming inside the rear view for rear view mirror with Home Link and Compass. Those are the ones that Home Link, you know, it's the one that ties you into Hyundai if something happens. Tilt and telescoping steering with auto cruise control and phone controls on the steering wheel.
That's great.
That's what I thought too. 4.2-inch LCD multi-information display and Bluetooth.
Wait a minute, hon. Did you talk about how about the reflector of the speed on the windshield? That reflector.
Heads-up display.
Well, explain that because you had to look for it and then you put it in. Go ahead.
Well, I haven't gotten to it yet.
All right.
Way to go, Lori.
I'm waiting for that touchdown. All right, go.
And it has an 8-inch color touch screen navigation system with a rear view monitor. It has the Android Apple AutoPlay. It has a 12-volt power outlet. It has heads up display and wireless device charging. The heads up display is a little plastic thing that comes up out of the dash in front of the drivers, and it reflects the speed and, I don't know, something else, I think. But you actually push a button for it, which I thought was cool because sometimes you get these things and you don't want them, and sometimes you do want them. And you actually push a button, and it comes up out of the dash for you. But then I love the fact that Hyundai puts these phone chargers right in the car. So right in front of the console, right in front of your gear shift, there's a nice area, and you just lay your phone in there, and it charges while you're going down the road, which I think that's a...
That's terrific.
It is. It's just a cool thing. I mentioned the 8-inch touch screen. Let's see what else. 315-watt radio. We had, of course, have XM. Great sound system. Infinity Premium Auto with...
And the radio was easy to program.
Yeah, very easy to program. Oh, the phone was easy to program, too. That's another thing I always look for, is how easy it is it when you press phone, you know, and it does it ask you, do you want to add a phone? Gives you the phones that are there and then asks you if you want to add one.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hit add a phone, then it asks you to do, you know, to make sure that you're... location is on your cell phone, and how easy is it? And it's very easy, and it really works automatically almost. All you got to do is push the buttons, and it does all of the hookup and downloading all your contacts and all that stuff. Yes,
I got to ask you. You know, you've driven a lot of Hyundai products, but this vehicle sounds like it's got everything. It's like not missing anything. Everything is standard in this $30,000 price tag.
Right.
It seems like it's an unbelievable amount of extras that are included in that price.
In
it's
a car this
amazing
size.
Amazing how much.
Right.
Yeah.
The things that I'm talking about that I think are really neat, you don't normally get on a car that's one of the smaller cars. That's, I guess, is my point. Yeah, you're right, Tessie. You're right. It's
I wonder whether car companies lose potential sales when they offer a car that has 2 and 3 and 4 tiers of options that you have to select from, or the latitude for a potential buyer to make to stipulate what they want for their options. Because my experience in marketing is the more choices you offer somebody,
the less
likely you are to make a sale.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that high end.
Yeah, but I got to ask you though.
Go ahead.
This Hyundai is fully loaded. I can't imagine what else you could put into it. But that's at the high end though. So how many models do they have? Because don't they start off at under 20 grand? Because there's a different entry point as well. I don't know if there's much of a difference though.
I
didn't get that for 2019.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, the one thing about this one is we have the new color that came out this year, which is like a burnt orange.
I love the new colors
orange.
Too.
Yeah, I love it.
Depends on the sunlight. In the shade, it looks like red. In the sunlight, it looks like red orange. And it's a very attractive.
Oh, wow.
Easy to find in the grocery store parking lot.
Back to your question, I didn't research that part of it, if there were different ones at different. But the way that this is, I know that there are different levels. For example, ours is an Ultimate. And because it's an Ultimate, it probably has all these things. There's actually one above ours. I forget what the name of it is. But it's,
okay.
And then there's two below it. So the ones below it probably don't have all of these things. But if you buy, so there are four models. If you buy X model, you get these things. If you buy Y model, you get these things. If you buy the Ultimate model, you get all these things. I think it's probably set up like that. And I want to say something about...
Well, that's fine. But that's fine. You know,
yeah.
I think...
No, I agree.
You know, sometimes,
no, I agree.
Sometimes you can't... Sometimes you just can't afford it all. That's the thing. And there's sometimes things that are not a question of safety features, but they may cut back somewhere else. Maybe you don't get leather seating or
XM radio.
Those sort of things that are just like, yeah, exactly. So that might be tolerable for a lot of people who need a lower entry point in order to be able to afford a vehicle. But this sounds like a really fantastic size.
Well, and this one had a sunroof. This one had a sunroof, opening,
you're
closes,
kidding.
Automatic.
Wow.
Oh, no. Had all those kind of, and that's, you are absolutely correct. I don't particularly care for sunroofs, but I'm going to tell you, I want all the rest of the stuff, and if it's all part of the package, I'm taking it. You know, I don't have to worry about can I afford it and should I order one without it.
And here's the other thing.
I'm follicly challenged, so I may not want a sunroof.
Right. But you can leave it closed, and you never know it's there.
But other than that.
Or you could wear a hat.
True.
But here's the thing I want to speak to.
That was the other thing.
A lot of your determination on your car also depends on how much you plan to drive it. Okay, so let's say that you are only driving a car 10,000 miles a year or under. It would behoove you the life expectancy of that car, well treated garage. You're going to go the long haul. You're talking about 10, 15 years easy with a Hyundai. Okay, in that instance, I would just as soon save a little extra. And spend a little extra for the kind that we had, the model we had, which is, you know, second from the top of the line, because you're going to have pleasure from it for 10, 15 years. If you want a car that on the low model, the entry level model of this Kona, you only plan on having it for say 5 years, and because you're expecting to, you know, have your family grow after 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll need a bigger car. Okay, then you can manage just fine with, you know, an entry-level model. So it depends really on who you are and how much you drive and what your vision is for the car. If it's a second car for a family, then I would say you're going to have it for many more years than it would be if it was your primary car, obviously. But, again, it depends on the person. It's not an overall blanket thing to say, well, you know, I would get a higher model Kona.
I have noticed that all the manufacturers are going in the direction where the safety features are becoming part and parcel of the vehicle. And
critical.
So prices have been rising because they're critical to the safety and function of a car, as well to protect the consumer and also other people on the road. So it makes sense. But they still have a lot of vehicles that have some of these features that are maybe the most necessary. And it's a judgment call, but there's an entry point. And look, a $30,000, price tag on this, all-wheel drive Kona Ultimate is phenomenal what you're getting for it. I was really quite surprised.
I had a lot of difficulty with the manufacturers that make what we are now considering the basic safety features an option. I find that unforgivable.
Right.
Let me say something, too, about this, because you brought up the thing about marketing. And we just pointed out that the Hyundai comes in four different categories, and most likely you get certain things with the category that you buy. This idea of all-inclusive marketing, I've been doing it for years, and what I'm saying is that people in general want to know, A, what does it cost, and B, don't tell me after I buy it that it costs more than you told me it did, if you understand what I'm saying. And this idea that you buy a car and then if you want this option, it's this. You get into, and it used to be true. You go to the dealerships and you would be confused, and they would say, well, you need this and that, and this only a little more, and it only adds this to your monthly payments. And so that was how they sold things. People don't like that. That's the truth. People do not like that approach to marketing or to sales. What they like is, what does it cost? Can I afford it, which you said earlier? And if I buy it, is it mine? I don't have to worry about anything else. Hyundai's moving much faster in that direction. And I believe that that strategy works. I really believe
it does.
Yeah, I really believe that that's what people want. What does this car cost? You get all this, it's $30,000. I can afford $30,000. I would like that car.
Mm-hmm.
It takes all of the guesswork out of purchasing something. And I like it. I'm telling you, every time we talk about them, I say they're on the edge. They're the ones who have studied the American market, and I think they know what they're doing.
Well, I remember when there was a company called Saturn. I think it was part of the General Motors. And they were the ones I think they were the first to come up with a price, and there was no haggling, and it was loaded to the hilt as far as the product was, and it fit into a specific segment, and people loved it. And it did very well. I don't know whatever happened to that particular line, but the whole marketing aspect did change because of it. And now we're seeing the effects even, 25 years later?
Yep, that's right.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. It is. You know, everybody is starting to pay attention, or at least the car companies that really want to sell are paying attention, paying a lot more attention, I think, I think the market's changed. Look at what the internet's done to our purchasing. You know, we don't go down to the store and shop three different stores, walking from place to place, trying on clothes and so forth. Because we've gone to clothing that fits everybody, or at least gets close, we tend to get online, look for what we like, find it in our size, and order it. If we don't like it, we send it back, and we get something else, or whatever. We get our money back, that kind of thing. So we've made it a lot more convenient to buy things. And I think this is what's going on with the car companies. You got to make it convenient. You got to make it easy. If you don't, they're going to find whoever has the easy button.
And here's the thing that I think is probably the most upsetting thing. Now I'm talking about things that would affect my choice of car. You know, the day of when we had product loyalty to American-made cars are over.
Yeah, unfortunately.
With the car companies doing mass firings of their people who have worked for them all their lives, people whose fathers and fathers before them, mothers, mothers before them worked for that company. Now all of a sudden they're giving 30 days notice before they're laid off for good. And the reason you ask why, well, because they're manufacturing parts and doing and putting the cars together outside the United States. So the American car companies that are depending upon foreign countries to manufacture their cars are not really American anymore, just in name. This bothers me. And so one of the reasons why I have for a very long time not wanted to look at anything but an American car manufacturer was because of brand loyalty and made, you know, buy American.
Mm-hmm. America. Yeah.
Buy American or buy
yeah.
America. Well, it doesn't work anymore. We haven't supported our own manufacturing that we stand by as a country. So with that in mind, would I buy a Hyundai because it's a superior product, because it has the kind of features
yeah.
that I'm looking for? And the answer, sadly, is yes.
Yeah. Well, not so sadly, because it's a good product. So,
right.
But again, you know, I think the game has been upped, right? Everybody
yes.
now realizes that you have to produce a good product. You can't be slacking off. You can't just be coasting on hot air. And marketing, you know, just like advertising is not going to make it. So you've got to have the product to back up what you're saying. And that's where it's at.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, unfortunately, we got to get going because I've got another guest on. But what a pleasure, guys. Enjoy the vehicle.
All
Thank
right.
you, buddy. Talk
week.
To you soon.
Good week.
Be
Bye-bye.
Good.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, well, there we have it. John and Lori Wiles from the Driving Me Crazy crowd. You got to love them. I mean, I do at least. So good morning, Ms. Beltran. How are you? Thanks for waiting.
Good morning.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you on today. And I appreciate your hanging in there. I hope you enjoyed the last few minutes of our Driving Me Crazy segment every Thursday. So what's going on with you? I mean, we're getting closer and closer. My God, it's almost June. It's only 25, 26 days before the actual election and the primary. And that's going to be almost the be-all and end-all of the process, I guess. So what engages you the most? What are you focusing on now as we approach the last 4 weeks, basically, of the election process that will culminate on the 25th? What's important
to you? Well, at
this
point, it's a get out the vote movement to get people to actually come mm-hmm. out to the polls on June 25th. My priority okay. has been the same from the beginning, engaging voters one-on-one, letting them get to know me and explain to them why I'm the best candidate and why we need a change in Yonkers. I did participate in a candidate night last night sponsored by the Ludlow Park Residents Association, mm. Park Hill, and Hudson River mm. Community Association last night at the Chima Center. And so that was another
mm-hmm.
opportunity for me to address a large crowd and to let them ask questions and to really just engage. A lot of them were community leaders on their own. I also saw and met a lot of new people. And it's about spreading the word, running a grassroots campaign on a shoestring budget. And so I have to do it this way. I have to get out there and be out there and talk to as many people as possible and hope that they are engaged enough and excited enough to come out to vote on June 25th.
Well, it's certainly a tried and true method of reaching out to voters, and I think it's a necessary aspect of really getting some traction for any elected office, and you can't deny that that's a necessary aspect of what needs to be done. So when you met all these people at the Chima Center yesterday, then did you What did they want to hear? What did you tell them that was pertinent for them to look at you as a credible candidate for the primary? What connected you to them that you found is indicative of their desire for the next mayor of the city?
Well, certainly what I wanted to share with them is my qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, the need for a change in Yonkers.
What are
and
those?
Also
we can go on and talk in circles, but what are your qualifications so that people understand? Otherwise, we're wasting a half hour of really precious time, and we want to know what you shared with those people at the Chima Center, because not everybody was there. So, you know,
that's
there
right.
Yes,
including the mayor. The mayor couldn't make it yesterday.
Okay. So that was an opportunity.
Yes, I was there. I definitely
lost.
Addressed the crowd.
So my qualifications, he lost an opportunity.
Yes, I am a Yonkers Public School graduate. I attended
okay.
elementary school, middle school, and high school in Yonkers. I also went on
uh-huh.
to SUNY institutions for undergrad and law school.
Well,
I majored
okay.
in anthropology since I've always had an interest in culture and in people and how that relates to our society
right.
and helping our society improve. So I've always had an interest in learning about new cultures and new people. I went on to law school, and I'm a public service attorney. I work in family court,
mm-hmm.
and I've been doing that for almost 12 years. So I'm a litigator.
Nice.
I'm in court all the time. But I also
right.
engage in a lot of negotiations with my cases. So I'm speaking to attorneys all the time and other related decision makers in the process. I have
mm-hmm.
clients who I talk to on a daily basis. I'm a good communicator. I'm a good person that listens and is able to settle matters and collaborate in really difficult situations. Family court matters are confidential. They're sensitive. They're high risk. And I've been
mm-hmm.
able to do that effectively for many, many years. It's a skill that I
bring.
Well,
I wanted to ask you before you go on, how do you translate all that experience when you come to think of it? How do you translate that to becoming a leader in governance? So here you are vying to become the mayor, and you're dealing with very sensitive issues in family court, and you're also contending with other very intelligent people who have maybe as much or a little less or a little bit more the knowledge of a particular situation that you may have, but it's part of that discourse between people, and so you end up having to come to a conclusion that's going to appease to some extent a little here and a little there, and you come to a balancing point. Is that a necessary part today in governance? Because we have very little of that today. We seemingly
yeah.
are at each other's throats. And is that civility something that you could bring into government?
Of course. And that just goes with my personality. I'm a pretty serious person. I listen and I discuss
mm-hmm.
matters, and everyone has a seat at the table. There was a question last night, although
okay.
not as the mayoral candidates, but for other candidates about
mm-hmm.
the lack of transparency in city government. And that question
mm-hmm.
was framed as that being a fact. And it's true. I mean, that's the perception that people have, that there are things going on in city government that are not explained thoroughly at the very least,
mm-hmm.
or that people don't know enough about. And that has to do with
mm-hmm.
actually addressing the issues and being honest about the issues and having the right people at the table. And if that takes more than one gathering at the table, then so be it. It's about letting people actually understand what the issues are so that we can move forward. And like you said
mm-hmm.
earlier, not just go around in circles about certain things and actually have a relationship where everyone is listening and coming up with solutions. That is what we need. And we don't need any further discussions about how we're not getting along and what people know and don't know, but actually figuring out a way
mm-hmm.
to get everyone on the same page. And that has to do with not only the workforce, but also, for example, parents of the Yonkers Public Schools and other people
right.
that are interested in other things within the city, community leaders, nonprofits, or other service providers. There's so many things that applies to, not just one segment of the government. And also, the
mm-hmm.
elected officials play a big role in that. But it's time to really broaden that circle and engage even more people in the process. And that is one of the reasons that I'm running to engage voters. A big part of my campaign has been educating people about the balloting process, about being registered mm-hmm. to vote. And by the way, the voter registration deadline for the primary is tomorrow, Friday, May 31st. So if there's anyone out there who's not registered to vote, they have until tomorrow to do so. Can't change parties, but you can register new voters by tomorrow. I also sent out a communication just earlier today about the process of applying for an absentee ballot. Right, just because you're not in town or you're otherwise mm-hmm. unable to get to the polls, you are able to vote by absentee ballot. So there's all these things. You know, I've also spoken to people who are not registered with a party, and I try to let them know what that means. It means they can't vote in primaries. And, you mm-hmm. know, they can make their own decision as to whether they want to remain non-party affiliated or if they want to join a party to be able to participate in this process, because, like even you said earlier, this is what matters, a process that matters in a city that's mostly Democratic. Whoever does win this mm-hmm. election is most likely to win the election in November.
Right.
So there's a lot of voter
right,
education
just from the demographic.
That needs to be shared
right, just from the-
out there.
Yeah, just from a demographic perspective and the amount of people registered as Democrats outweighing the number of Republican registered.
Right. But we suffer from low voter turnout.
People.
We suffer
that's
from
another,
low voter turnout, and it's been like that for decades.
I got to ask you, though, everything that you've said is extremely compelling. Is there a way to change government? Is it... it's not only in Yonkers that we have this desire by many people, not by everybody, for greater transparency, greater inclusiveness. Are there examples out there that we can look at and say, oh, well, they're doing it right in, you know, whatever place in whatever state in or whatever village in even New York State where it's happening? How do we infuse that sort of community, interest to actually coalesce and engage in particular issues so that at the end there's an outcome that's beneficial for the greater good and you know, in the majority, in a sense, really. Are we covering all those issues? What's missing in our discourse, or don't we have enough discourse?
Well, what we need is more people in government, so we need more different kinds of people to run for office, people that voters uh-huh. can actually relate to. So we need to change that as well, that, you know, the fact that not only one kind of person can run for office, that really you even
But why are you veiling your comments with, you know, like these are buzzwords? Yeah, why can't we just simply say that African Americans have not been a part of the process, or Hispanics have been maligned in the process? So that's part of what the
well,
words
not
inclusion
just about
are, and
that.
We are not yet able. So what is it then?
Yeah. Well, it's not just that. I mean, there's even a broader thing. Women. We've never had a female mayor in Yonkers. It's about time we had that perspective. So I'm a big proponent of that, looking at it from that perspective first. And it is true, like you said,
so
and I mentioned last
bring?
Night.
What does that bring? You know, but again, we have to talk in reality. So there is a different
that means
perspective
that, our priority,
that one can gain from a
yes.
woman. What does that mean? Okay.
Yes, for me, that means that our priorities have to shift. Have to shift to issues that affect children and family, because that is what women care about the most. Making sure that our educational system is as best as it can be. Making sure that our young adults and our partners are able to have opportunities mm-hmm. and access to good paying jobs, making sure that there are quality community services out there for our families to use. These are things that affect families on a day-to-day basis, and those are the things that we need to mm-hmm. prioritize, not economic development that doesn't impact the community and doesn't benefit the community in obvious and clear ways.
Okay. Well, I concur with you. I do think, though, economic development is a necessary aspect to pay for issues that haven't been ameliorated yet. And I don't know how long that will take, probably decades, but not just months or years. But so it's a very compelling issue. And are women making a strong enough effort to give expression to the value of having a woman in a leadership role that is different from a male role? Because we've basically had males at the at the top of the totem pole, so to speak, and they haven't always done so well.
That's right. And there is a trend towards more women running for office and being elected for office and governing. And I take inspiration mm-hmm. from that. I'm lucky to have been raised in a time where I had very good examples of that. And I see very good examples of that every day. I see it mm-hmm. everywhere, including, you know, other fellow Run for Something candidates and locally
right.
and even in the national landscape with a record number of
mm-hmm.
women running for the Democratic line for president.
Right.
So I take inspiration from that. It's not easy running as a first-time candidate. It's not easy running not being party endorsed. It's not easy running as a parent. It's not easy running as a person who's still working full-time. And we need to
mm-hmm.
focus our energies on making that easier and making that more possible. And voters need to support candidates that they are excited about and that they want to see in office and assist with spreading the word and volunteering for those campaigns so that it is possible. Otherwise, the system works as it's designed to work, and that's keeping the same people in power election cycle after election cycle.
Well, one thing I've got to ask you about that, when it comes to women candidates, there are many compelling people who are running for office, such as you, and of course you are a woman, but you're educated, and you are also educated, and you have the capacity. Are other women supportive of another woman, or is there something that is like a disconnect? Are women voting for women? Are women coming out to vote for women who espouse similar concepts and ideas, whether it be with birth control issues, having control of their own bodies, issues that are coming up now with respect to abortions, and so on and so forth. Is there a reluctance to vote for women by women? And are there more men that are considering women now, I think, than ever before?
I think women are key. I think women are able to relate to other women candidates for sure, and to the issues
mm-hmm.
surrounding the candidacy of women candidates and the priorities that women candidates
right.
bring to the table. There are a lot
uh-huh.
more men that are supportive as well. So I talk to everyone, but I can't say for sure that when I talk to women, they're very supportive. They're excited about the possibility. And it's a common phrase to say, you know, it's about time that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't happened as
right.
president yet. We came close. We've had successes in state offices. And really, it starts from
mm-hmm.
the bottom up as well. So we can't just look at it as we have to wait till we have a woman president and then it'll trickle down. No, we have to start at the local
no.
level and hope that it just continues right. to build for many, many years and in many states and many cities and many local municipalities. There just has never been a woman filling those top spots. And why
right.
not? Why not? Why
mm-hmm.
can't we be mayors and governors and county executives? Why are we deputies? Why are we commissioners? And even in the city, that's not the case, right? We did have a deputy mayor who was a female who's no longer there, and very few, I'm not sure if it's even more than one commissioner who's a female. And we also have a lack of diversity
mm-hmm.
At that level. So we do
right.
need to be honest about that and figure out how to change that. It's not that there's not enough qualified women out there. It's not that. It's that we need to make it a priority to seek out those candidates and support them. And the whole community has to do that. It can't just be the party in charge of doing
mm-hmm.
that, because
well, the party
it hasn't
makes its own
yet.
Decision, not necessarily looking at a woman on an equal footing as a male candidate, because that's part of who they were. So it may take longer to move that vote around.
Well, it shouldn't. We waited long enough.
Yeah, right. So it is time to make that change. Are women ready to make that change, or are they just mouthing and saying, things that sound encouraging, but when it comes to the voting booth, they're not casting their ballot as they usually espoused? Because I've never understood why credible people could not. We'll find out together the evening of June 25th.
We'll find out together the June, locally if that's true or not. I think nationally, women have come out to vote and have supported other women candidates. So that's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting women to come out and vote for the best candidate, the person that they think will make their lives better, lives of their children better, who will support the initiatives that they care about on a day-to-day basis.
And that is really, really quite interesting because, women do embody a sense of interest, concern, even love for their children and other children as well, not just their own.
That's right.
Assuming their mothers, but that nurturing aspect, it does come out. It's almost like it's part of the DNA. And so you would think that we would have moved ahead. There are other countries around the world where women in leadership roles has been going on for 30, 40, 50 years. It's truly amazing. And no one has ever even suggested that women in leadership roles have failed in any way, shape, or form.
Do you think that younger who would be going through this budget cycle of lack of funding for the public schools for this many decades, if we have had more women as mayor here, if you have children in the youngest public schools, there's no way you would have let this happen for so many decades. And I'm not blaming one administration or the other. This is a cycle that has been in place for so long.
I am familiar.
I truly believe that if we had a woman mayor throughout, that we wouldn't be in the situation we're in now, because women understand the importance of having a good education system and everything that comes with that, the quality services, the opportunities to make children well-rounded, the opportunities for them to be college and career ready, and both, not just one over the other. There, the need for our partners and other people, all the adults in our families, to have access to good paying jobs, for our parents who are senior citizens to be able to live close to where we live so they can assist in family rearing. All those things are important to a family, and those are the issues that I want to focus on. You mentioned women who are not parenting, but same thing. They also have parents that they want to make sure are taken care of.
Right.
They have other relatives that are children. It's really encompasses everything about a community. So a lot of the things that I do say have to do with being a parent. I've been a parent really long time, over 24 years now. So that is who I am. But it doesn't mean that I'm not thinking, considering people that are non-parents. There are a lot of people who are no longer rearing children or whose children are now adults and don't have grandchildren. So basically what we need to do is make sure everyone knows what the issues are and make sure everyone is interested. And everyone is. People care about community, even if they can't personally relate or are not exactly in the same situation. And a big way that we improve the city. A big way that we improve the city is making sure that our children are taken care of. And whether that has a lot to do with the school district, and it has a lot to do with the services we offer them outside of school as well.
This has been happening under many administrations, at least for 20 years that I'm aware of, because I've only been here about 20 years. in Yonkers. So the I guess the thing that I find compelling is that we have the same issues with regard to education all this time. Are these issues of education, or are they issues of bigotry and bias because of our changing demographic and Yonkers is changing, or did we also lose sight of family values and are we starting to come back to them? Is that what's the impetus for this change in attitude that we hear being spoken about, and now maybe it will be changed at the ballot box? So what's
the
catalyst?
I hope so. I mean, nationally, public education is a big issue. That needs to be addressed at the federal level for sure. And that goes not only for elementary education, but also so many of our students who are shackled by school, college, loan debt. Yes, that's an important issue.
Right.
So, it's not just about elementary academics. At the state level, there's been a lack of sufficient funding there as well for many years, and I acknowledge that, and I've heavily advocated for that. But also locally, there are issues that we need to address and be honest about. I mean, we did have a big desegregation case here in Yonkers in the 80s, and I went to school during that time period. So I have some recollection of that, and as an adult, I learned even more about it. And it's fascinating to me. And we do have to ask ourselves why it happened and why we let it happen. And now that we're at this point, we need to really discuss that in an honest way and figure out a way to amend for any lack of funding that happened during that time period or any neglect that happened during that time period and start fixing it. So that has to be the priority. But everyone has to be on board with that. How do you make people on board with an important issue is transparency. You're honest about what the issues are. Senior citizens need to know what's happening in the public schools, good and bad, so that they're in it, so that they also come to Albany with us to advocate. Retired people need to know what's going on so that they also advocate, because property owners, taxpayers, everyone has to...
Well, people ask for transparency, and I really wonder if that's what they want. I'm not questioning what the definition is of transparency to you. It seems logical that you want to divulge the facts the way they are, the reality the way it is. And yet we don't have that sense of discourse. So, but is it possible to manage both positive as well as negative issues that come out of the introspection of any particular issue, whether it be schooling, funding, bias, job opportunity, schooling and costs that are associated with it, and so on and so forth, and a job opportunity. Is it possible
to do that?
Yes, I think
that's what people want. People don't want to just hear what's good. This is not about public relations only. We need to educate our people and inform our citizens about things that we need to improve on, because it's going to take everyone to improve it. You can't just tell people good things. You have to really let them know what the reality is so that everyone knows, and we can work together towards a solution to that. For too long, we've masked what the issues are. We don't thoroughly discuss them, except at budget time when we're begging for money. Well, what about the rest of the school year? All you hear is good things. How do you expect people to galvanize, to advocate only during certain weeks or months of the school year? And not the others. Everything's fine otherwise. No, things happen throughout the year that need to be shared with the public so that everyone is on the same page about them. We can finally start moving towards improving and having more than just parents advocate for one thing or the other. And that applies across the spectrum on different issues as well. It applies us to housing as well and economic development or issues arising out of that. So I'm focusing on education to explain the issue, but it applies to other segments and other issues as well.
Right. Well, I got to ask you.
It's very hard to engage people if they think everything's fine or that it will resolve itself. That's not true. Everything is not fine, and things are not just going to resolve themselves through the efforts of elected officials and a couple of green leaders. Mm. It has to take a broader segment of the population to do that, obviously, because it hasn't worked yet. Something has to change.
That's really quite true. Unfortunately, because we're down to like about 30 seconds before our next segment, I wanted to ask you if you would be kind to give us your website address so that people can still be engaged and possibly consider coming out and casting their vote for you.
Thank you so much. This half hour went by quick. My website is KarenBeltranForMayor.com. I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter as well. I do have a fundraiser next week, Wednesday. It's going to be in White Plains, and you can find more information about that in the website and social media as well. I'm trying to make as many events as possible, so if you see me out there, please engage. I'm open to answering questions and learning and listening as well. And thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Do you still have your curly hair? So does that help people recognize you?
I do still have my curly hair.
Okay.
And I'm not, you know, that's not going anywhere. I'm a pretty simple person, and that's how I wear my hair, and it's not going anywhere.
Okay. It's very good looking.
Thank
it's very
you for
attractive.
Asking.
No problem. But this way people will recognize you in case you're walking down the street, and even in White Plains, they'll say, oh, I know that lady. Okay.
Yes,
very
yes.
good. Well, all the best. I am looking forward to our next discussion and to have
Thank
a
you.
Successful fundraiser. Be well. Thank you.
Bye.
Well, there we have it, folks. Karen Beltran, she is running in the Democratic primary that will take place on the 25th of June. And as she pointed out in the discussion we had with her today, is that tomorrow is the final day to sign up for your party affiliation so that you can take you can cast your ballot for the June 25th primary, which will be the deciding factor because the demographics are such that Democrats are out-register Republicans in the city of Yonkers to such an unbelievable differential between the two parties that whoever wins the Democratic Party designation will be the next mayor. So that's the bottom line. Well, so we're going to hear in a moment from Mount Vernon mayoral candidate Andre Wallace. We're going to be talking to him. Let me just see. Yeah, okay. I just was looking to see if in case I made a mistake with the time, but no, this is the right time. So hopefully he'll be giving us a call in a moment, and then we'll see what happens there. So there are a lot of things that certainly that are happening in Mount Vernon. I'm very pleased to say that because of our sources, we were the first to even point out that Larry Picari, the Corporation Counsel of the City of Mount Vernon, was going to need to turn himself in. He was going to be arrested otherwise, and he did show up on Wednesday, and we pointed that out over the weekend. Or anyone even knew that he was in the crosshairs anyplace. So that was really cool. And it's always nice to be at the cutting edge, as they say. And we've also evolved. I don't know if you know, we've evolved our focus because we have so many interests and people from the general area in Westchester County that look to us as a source. And so now you could find us by going to Mount Vernon Tribune or Bronxville Tribune or Westchester Tribune. It all feeds into the Yonkers Tribune website. But if you press any one of those other website addresses like Bronxville Tribune, then you will go immediately to the Bronxville page. So this way you know specifically what will be covered. And then if you go to the generic Westchester Tribune, then you get not only those cities that we cover specifically or villages that we cover specifically, but also there are other places that are engaged as well. So there, you know, this way it gives you a better sense of what's happening. And And that's just like, for example, I think we posted, I may not have even posted it yesterday, but I was working on it yesterday. I'm sure a lot of people remember Kat Bresler. She was running for political office here in Yonkers at one time. And then I think she moved to Tuckahoe. And she's now residing in White Plains. The Common Council had challenged her petitions. She wanted to run for Common Council. It's like our version of the city council. They call it Common Council over there in White Plains. And they, even though she had like over just shy of 1,000 votes more that were validated by the Westchester County Board of Elections, she was challenged by members of the three other members that were vying for political office to be elected to the Common Council. They challenged her. She ended up taking the case to the appellate court based in Brooklyn. They issued a statement saying that her signatures are valid. She will be on the ballot. So good for her. For standing her ground and also having the financial capacity to see the case move to a higher level. It is so difficult to win justice and to validate the integrity of one's efforts, unfortunately, without a tremendous infusion of funding. And that is, well, it's a process. Everyone needs to get paid, and it is unfortunate because sometimes if you're not well-funded, if you don't have enough support, you'll never be able to get the justice and the validity to your effort, which is very, very disconcerting to say the least. Well, unfortunately, I haven't seen anything come out from Mr. Andre Wallace, so we're not going to be able to speak to him, evidently. And so we're going to move on to some different issues right now, and we're going to cover. Bear with me a moment. I want to go over to my page. Yes, we're going to cover some other issues on a world scale. So one thing that's really, really compelling, unfortunately, is a tragedy that occurred in Hungary. A boat carrying dozens of South Korean tourists capsized in the Hungarian capital. So at least 8 people were killed and 21 are missing after a pleasure boat carrying South Korean tourists capsized on the flooding Danube River in the Hungarian capital. That was yesterday, police and ambulance had said. Police said the boat had been carrying 33 South Korean tourists plus a crew of 2. And state media cited a South Korean embassy official as saying that the passengers included children. The River Danube has flooded and the boat was battling strong currents when it struck a larger passenger vessel and sunk almost immediately on impact. The catastrophe amidst stormy weather occurred near the Hungarian Parliament building in Budapest. So, police have launched a criminal investigation into the accident, and the police said it may take days to lift the tourist boat from the riverbed and are therefore unable to give further information about the missing. A major rescue mission is underway with boats and divers and spotlights and radar scanning along the river for survivors. Dozens of emergency vehicles are currently on a stretch several kilometers downstream from the accident site, which happened shortly after 9 p.m. Yesterday. So many of the rescued are suffering from hypothermia but remain stable. Journalists at the scene said they saw children's ambulances on the riverbank. The hours that have passed since the accident make it less likely that survivors will be found. As the strong currents may have carried people far downstream, emergency rescue chiefs had said, so the waters of the Danube are only about 10 to 12 degrees Celsius, that's 50 to 54 degrees Fahrenheit. So the National Ambulance Service is conducting searches along a stretch downstream from Budapest, and the entire Danube south of Budapest is on alert. All river traffic has been halted, and television footage showed the bank of the Danube closed off by police across from the World Heritage Site of Buda Castle. The boat was 89 feet, a double-decker river cruise boat that can hold up to 60 people and was equipped with a 150-horsepower engine. Its owner, Panorama Deck Limited, told state media. The Mermaid had been in their fleet since 2003 and received regular maintenance, they said. According to Boat Register, Hajóhes Gister, that's Hungary, that's the register, the Mermaid was originally manufactured in 1949 in the Soviet Union and received a Hungarian-made new engine in the 1980s. Neither the boat registry nor the boat's operator could be immediately reached for comment on the boat's age. The hull of the boat was found on the riverbed just a few hundred yards from its usual mooring point. So that is one of the just a major, major tragedy, loss of life, which is just gut-wrenching. What can I tell you? Well, now let's go over to some other international news. Israel faces new elections as Netanyahu's government fails to form a coalition. So Israeli lawmakers voted to dissolve parliament early on Thursday, paving the way for a new election after veteran Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to form a coalition government before a midnight deadline. On September 17, the September 17 ballot will be Israel's second this year. It spells unprecedented upheaval, even for a country used to political infighting, and is a big blow to Netanyahu, who had claimed victory in the last election on April 9. Parliament's 74-45 vote took place just minutes after a midnight deadline for Netanyahu to assemble his fifth government. The turmoil arose, officially at least, from a feud over military conscription between Netanyahu's presumed allies, ex-defense minister Avigdor Lieberman, a far-right secularist, and ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties. Those parties want young religious scholars exempted en masse from mandatory national service, but Lieberman and many other Israelis want them to share the burden. Netanyahu denounced the draft spat as a Kafkaesque ruse. It's just unbelievable. Avigdor Lieberman is now part of the left, he told reporters. It is perfectly clear that he wanted to topple this government to cobble together a few more votes. Yet the new ballot represents less of a setback for Netanyahu than the alternative to in which Israel's president, Reuven Rivlin, could have asked another politician to try and form a ruling coalition. So faced with a prospect of having to step aside and watch one of his political rivals push him to the margins, Netanyahu instead drummed up votes to dissolve the 120-seat Knesset. That's their parliament. Netanyahu signaled he will run in the next election, telling reporters, "We will win." The spokesman for his conservative Likud party sent out a text emoji showing a smiling Netanyahu with a message, "Get out and vote." But the failed coalition building of a 69-year-old leader who just weeks ago was hailed by supporters as a political magician may open rifts and stir up challenges within Likud. The premier is also dogged by potential criminal charges in three corruption cases. He has denied wrongdoing and is due to argue at a pretrial hearing in October against any indictment. A new election could further complicate U.S. efforts to press ahead with President Donald Trump's peace plan in the Israeli parliament conflict. Even before it has been announced, Palestinians have spurned it as a blow to their statehood hopes. The White House team behind the proposal, including Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is in the Middle East to drum up support for an economic workshop, quote-unquote, in Bahrain next month to encourage investment in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The group arrived in Israel on Wednesday and planned to meet Netanyahu on Thursday. Lots to pray for, tweeted one of the envoys, Jason Greenblatt, from Jerusalem's Western Wall. 3 hours before Wednesday's 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time deadline, Likud said it had secured 60 signatures, half of parliament, but shy of the majority required for a measure of stable governance. In another sign of Netanyahu's strong desire to retain the premiership, the opposition center-left Labour Party said it had been offered and had refused a chance to join a Likud-led coalition. Likud, which has long said it plans to head a strong right-wing government, neither denied or confirmed this. First elected in the late 1990s, Netanyahu has been in power for the past decade. In mid-July, he will overtake Israel's founding father, David Ben-Gurion, as the longest-serving premier. The last election ended with Netanyahu neck and neck against Benny Gantz, a political, untested ex-armed forces chief. Now, Lieberman, who quit the defense ministry in November, in protest at what he deemed insufficient Israeli military force in fighting Hamas in Gaza, has denied allegations that his real intention was to oust Netanyahu and lead a national camp. Until the drama over coalition building, public attention has been focused more on moves that Netanyahu loyalists were planning in parliament to grant him immunity from criminal prosecution and to pass a law ensuring such protection could not be withdrawn by the Supreme Court. So, very, very compelling to say the least. Let me just quickly go back to our studio screen. So, Mr. Wallace has not shown up, no problem. So we'll just move on with other issues in the international marketplace. Now, this is interesting, trying to follow up on what's been going on with the blast in Lyon. So the Lyon blast suspect pledged allegiance to the Islamic State group. Well, the man suspected to have planted a parcel bomb in the central French city of Lyon that wounded 13 people last week has told investigators that he had pledged allegiance to the Islamic State group, a judicial source said on Thursday. That's today. Police arrested the main suspect, a 24-year-old Algerian computer student, and three other people in connection with the case on Monday. He admitted having made the parcel bomb and deposited it late on a Friday afternoon, not far from Lyon-Perrache train station, in front of a bakery, a judicial source close to the investigation advised. The suspect was arrested along with his mother, his father, and another Algerian student who is a family friend, according to Paris prosecutors. The suspect, who has not been named, is an internet technology student who was previously unknown to the police. Lyon's mayor, Gerard Colomb, told reporters earlier this week. He had been the target of an extensive manhunt since late Friday when an explosive device filled with screws and ball bearings was placed in front of a bakery near the corner of two crowded pedestrian streets in the historic center of Lyon. Sources close to the investigation suspected the explosive was acetone peroxide, or APEX, a volatile compound used in deadly Paris attacks that happened in November or on November 13 of 2015. Investigators recovered small screws, ball bearings, and batteries, along with a printed circuit and a remote-controlled trigger device. And officials later said the charge was relatively weak. 13 people were wounded in the blast, 8 women, 4 men, and a 10-year-old girl, of whom 11 needed hospital treatment. And France has been on high alert following a wave of deadly jihadist terror attacks since 2015, which have killed more than 250 people. Unbelievable. Who would have thought? But that's exactly what's gripping France. Now, one other thing I wanted to speak to you about. One second here. You know, this we hadn't covered with you before. Evidently, Algeria is probing a prominent Berber rights activist's death in custody. Algeria is set to investigate the death in custody of a prominent human rights activist, Kamel Edine Fekhar, the country's justice ministry announced yesterday. Fekhar, a leading advocate for the Mozabites, a minority Berber community, died on Tuesday while being held in pretrial detention. The 54-year-old activist had been on a hunger strike, according to his family, since his arrest in late March for, quote, undermining state security, end quote. His lawyer, Salah Dabouz, has accused judicial authorities of being responsible for Fekhar's death. Fekhar was held in Gardaia, about 300 miles south of the capital of Algiers for weeks in inhumane conditions, said the lawyer. A medical doctor by profession, Kahar died at a hospital in the northern Algerian city of Blida after being transferred there in a comatose state, said Dabouz. That's the lawyer again. In a video posted on his Facebook page, Dabouz denounced, quote, this planned death by the judicial authorities of Gardaia, who, he said, detained Fihar without reason. In a statement issued on Wednesday, the Ministry of Justice said it had instructed the relevant services to carry out an in-depth investigation into the circumstances of the death of Kamel Eddine Fihar. Fihar was first arrested in 2015 during unrest in the Emzab Valley, where Gardaia is the largest city, between the country's Berber-speaking Mozabite minority and Cha'amba Arabs. The Berbers were the original inhabitants of North Africa before the 7th century Arab invasion and account for about 30% of Algeria's 41 million people. Tensions over land between the Berber and Arab communities spiraled into clashes back in 2015, sparking Fihar's arrest. He was released in July of 2017, but rearrested in March following an interview in which he criticized the Algerian state's segregationist attitudes toward Mozabites in Gardaia. Fihar's death sparked demonstrations in Algiers, with some protests carrying placards accusing le pouvoir, a term used to refer to the Algerian regime, of assassinating Fihar. Now, mass demonstrations against the le pouvoir in Algeria led to the resignation last month of the ailing president Abdelaziz Bouteflika, but demonstrations have continued with protests accusing Bouteflika's allies of organizing elections that were scheduled on July 4 but are likely to be delayed. Fihar's death has grown and drawn attention once again to Algeria's judicial harassment, sparking condemnation from Algerian and international human rights organizations. Amnesty International called on Algerian authorities to, quote, immediately review their repressive policies and the shameful treatment of activists and protesters, end quote, adding that the country must allow for freedom of expression and the right to demonstrate peacefully. Algeria's League for the Defense of Human Rights and the Front of Socialist Forces, Algeria's oldest opposition group, had both also demanded justice. In 2016, a British-Algerian journalist died while serving a two-year jail term for, quote, offending, end quote, Algeria's president. Mohamed Tarmat's lawyer said he had lapsed into a coma after going on a hunger strike. Unbelievable, the stuff that goes on in the world stage, and we need to be extremely, extremely careful of it. Now, this is very interesting as well. Again, on the international landscape, China accuses the United States of naked economic terrorism. China accused the United States of naked economic terrorism today as Beijing ramps up the rhetoric in the trade wars. The world's top two economies are at loggerheads as trade talks have apparently stalled, with U.S. President Donald Trump hiking tariffs on Chinese goods early this month and blacklisting telecom giant Huawei. We are against the trade war, but we are not afraid of it, Vice Foreign Minister Zhang Huawei said it at a press briefing to preview President Xi Jinping's trip to Moscow to Russia next week. So, this premeditated instigation of a trade conflict is naked economic terrorism, economic chauvinism, and economic bullying, Zhang had said, stressing that China opposes the systematic use of sanctions, tariffs, and protectionism. Quote, there is no winner in a trade war, he warned, and China has hit hard with its own tariff increase that will take effect on June 1, while state media has suggested that Beijing could stop exports of rare earths to the United States, depriving Washington of a key resource used to make high-tech products. Meanwhile, state media and officials have stepped up the rhetoric, capping patriotic fervor as the Communist Party digs in for what could be a long fight with the United States. an anchor for the English language state broadcaster China Global Television Network, CGTN, even held a rare debate on Thursday with a presenter from Fox Business Network to discuss the trade war after jousting on social media. The debate between CGTN's Liu Xin and Fox Business's Trish Regan was civil, with the American journalist saying, quote, "I appreciate you being here," end quote, and the Chinese anchor inviting her to come to China, adding, quote, "I will take you around," end quote. But China's propaganda apparatus has stepped up the rhetoric. Quote, "We advise the U.S. to not underestimate China's ability to safeguard its own development rights and interests. And not to say we didn't warn you," the party's mouthpiece, the People's Daily, said in an editorial on Wednesday, warning that rare earths could be used as a countermeasure. China produces more than 95% of the world's rare earths, and the United States relies on the Asian superpower for upwards of 80% of its imports. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, asked about the rare earths threat during an interview, said that Americans have already lost and suffered for decades under the current rules, said that Trump's singular focus is to push back on China. He renewed his attack on Huawei, saying there was a deep connectivity between the company and the Chinese state that had no parallel in the U.S. system. If it's the case that the Chinese Communist Party wanted to get information from technology that was in the possession of Huawei, it is almost certainly the case that Huawei would provide that to them, he told the Fox Business Network. Huawei has rejected the criticism and on Tuesday filed a motion for summary judgment, hoping it would swiftly win a lawsuit against U.S. legislation that bars federal agencies from using the company's equipment. This trade conflict will also have a serious negative impact on the development and revival of the global economy, Zhang had said on Thursday. That's today. Now, while Washington and Beijing spar, President Xi is preparing to meet with President Vladimir Putin from June 5 to June 7 as the neighboring giants forge closer ties. China and Russia have broad consensus and common interest on the trade war issue, Zhang had said. China and Russia will certainly strengthen economic and trade cooperation, including cooperation in various fields such as economic and trade investments, he added. We will certainly respond to various external challenges, do what we have to do, develop our economies, and constantly improve the living standard of our two peoples. So, very bold, very, you know, exact. So, it is just really very, very interesting. Now, the next big question is what's happening with respect to Mueller. Evidently, Mueller has passed the baton to Congress for any action against Trump. So this is going to be very, very compelling. Bear with me a moment. So it seems that investigators break their silence. He breaks his silence, and the indictment was not an option, and the president says the case is closed. Well, Robert Mueller, who investigated Donald Trump and Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election, has passed responsibility for any further action against the president to Congress. Special counsel said that the U.S. required a process other than the criminal justice system, quote unquote, to accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. Mr. Mueller said indicting the president was never an option and reiterated that his report, first published in April, did not exonerate or accuse Mr. Trump of obstructing justice. A president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office, the special prosecutor said in a statement to reporters. Quote, "If we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said that." Mr. Mueller's first public comments on his 22-month investigation were immediately seized upon by some Democrats who have been pushing for the impeachment of the president, adding to pressure on the party leadership, which has resisted such a move. His words stuck to the findings of his official report, which detailed Russia's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election and outlined numerous instances of possible obstruction of justice by the president. They stood in contrast to Mr. Trump's response to the report, which the president has said cleared his name. Mr. Trump responded on Twitter yesterday that Mr. Mueller's findings had not changed. Quote, there was insufficient evidence, and therefore in our country, a person is innocent. The case is closed. Thank you. Cory Booker, a Democratic senator from New Jersey and presidential candidate, said Mr. Mueller's statement had made clear that Congress, quote, has a legal and moral obligation to begin impeachment proceedings immediately. Kamala Harris, also a Democratic candidate, said what Robert Mueller basically did was return an impeachment referral. Now it is up to Congress to hold this president accountable. We need to start impeachment proceedings. It's our constitutional obligation. Other senior Democrats continue to hold back from calling outright for impeachment, an issue that has proved sharply divisive among party members. Gerald Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, which would conduct an impeachment investigation, said Congress had to, quote, respond to the crimes, lies, and other wrongdoing of President Trump, end quote, in a statement following Mr. Mueller's remarks, but did not mention impeachment. Democrats in Congress have sought Mr. Mueller's public testimony for months, but have so far been unable to secure his appearance. They have been keen to focus the public's attention on Mr. Mueller's final report and probe on how William Barr, the Attorney General, summarized his findings. Mr. Mueller, a former FBI director, indicated he had no interest in testifying. He said he was resigning as special counsel and leaving the Justice Department to return to private life. Quote, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak about this matter, he said. He stressed there was, quote, insufficient evidence, end quote, to charge a broader conspiracy between Russia and the Trump campaign, but added, quote, there were multiple systemic efforts to interfere in our election, and that allegation deserved the attention of every American. So, unbelievable. Okay, so let's look at some other issues. Let me quickly go back to our studio screen just in case something's come forward. But no, we're cool. We're fine. It is 11:30. Now, let me just quickly look and see what else is going on here that I wanted to talk to you about. And one second. Oh, my goodness. All right. What I'm going to do at the moment is I'm going to give you a moment, see a commercial break from about the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back. We'll be back. Sorry.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834. Or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Yonkers Tribune. This is Westchester Unlevered, but in case you're interested in reaching out to the Yonkers Tribune, you can reach them at their office, cell, text, or voicemail. Same number, 347-415-4326. And again, 347-415-4326. And I want to go back to our studio screen and play for you what's happening at the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge.
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show.
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Well, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. Well, let's go on and talk about some other issues, of course. And this is very interesting because evidently Emmanuel Macron, president of France, his government is under fire as General Electric has cut 1,000 jobs in France. Labor unions and opposition politicians reacted with outrage after the U.S. industrial conglomerate General Electric announced Tuesday that it would cut more than 1,000 jobs in France, mainly at its gas turbine operations in the east of the country. While details have not been finalized, General Electric's plan called for cutting up to 1,044 positions, mainly at its site in Belfort, eastern France, which employs nearly 4,000 people. The industrial cathedral of Belfort is burning, and the government is stoking the flames, said unions representing workers at the site in a joint press conference. GE said that up to 792 positions could be cut at the Belfort gas plant, along with 252 dedicated to support functions, and the proposed reductions are separate from the 1,000 jobs GE said it cut from its power unit in the first quarter. More than half the number of employees in the gas activities are going to lose their jobs. The mayor of Belfort, Damien Meslow, and other local officials said in a statement on Tuesday. They warned of new hardship for the region, which has been hit hard by the decline of mining and heavy industry over the past decades. These latest cuts are part of a wave of European layoffs from General Electric as it tries to stem losses in its power generation business. In 2015, the company announced 6,500 job cuts across Europe, and 2 years later, it revealed a further 12,000 cuts. We're asking for the government to stop this scandal. This carnage, whose only goal is to move jobs out of France, said a union representative, Philippe Petit-Cordon. Now, French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire said on Tuesday he would fight to save jobs at the plant and, quote, preserve Belfort's industrial future, end quote. Well, very nice. Emmanuel Macron, speaking from Brussels, where he's meeting with European leaders, said his government would be extremely vigilant, end quote, in negotiations with GE over the announced job cuts, too little, too late. But those statements have not satisfied the plant's unions or opposition politicians who accused the government of playing a role in job cuts. French industrial group Alstom was Belfort's biggest employer until 2014 when it sold its gas turbine manufacturing business to General Electric, which pledged to create 1,000 jobs to win backing for the deal from the French government. It was Emmanuel Macron, then just named finance minister by President François Hollande, who gave the green light to the deal against the advice of his predecessor. In the end, GE created just 25 new jobs at the Belfort site, and in February of this year agreed to pay 50 million euros into a reindustrialization fund for falling short of the target. Shame on France, said Bastien Faudeau, an elected official for the Belfort area. GE had committed to creating 1,000 jobs in France, and that has finally translated to cutting 1,050. Manon Aubry, just elected to the European Parliament as head of the left populist La France Insoumise, the France Unbowed list, said that the announcement, quote, was opportunely timed after the European elections, given that Macron is directly responsible for this disaster, end quote. Aubrey also pinned a share of the blame on Hugh Bailey, who served as an advisor to Macron when he was finance minister and now directs General Electric France. As general manager of the company's French operations, Bailey has overseen the restructuring program that led to Tuesday's announcement of job cuts. Fabien Roussel, National Secretary of the French Communist Party, the PCF, said Bailey's involvement in the deal is a symbol of a corrupted France. Julien Aubert, a parliamentarian with the right-wing Les Républicains, likewise denounced a state lie, quote-unquote, adding that an industrial jewel had been sold off. GE said the job reductions were necessary to cut costs and make the company's French operations more efficient in response to a shrinking market for power plants. The company has struggled for years with slumping demand for its gas turbine because of low oil and gas prices, and the power operations were a key factor in its massive annual loss of $22.8 billion last year. GE said it has about 16,000 employees at 20 industrial locations in France, and the country houses General Electric's headquarters for five divisions: renewable, hydro, and offshore wind power generation, plus grid and power conversion units. Agnès Pannier-Runacher, France's Secretary of State for Economy and Finance, said the government was awaiting, quote, exemplary, end quote, conduct from General Electric and would be, quote, very demanding, end quote, in negotiations over the job cuts. We'll just see what these stupid government people say, and if it ever comes to be realized, that really would be unbelievable. I doubt seriously it's going to happen. Anyway, so let's quickly look and see what else is happening, because there's so much that is on the world stage. Quickly go over here. I think we covered, we did cover everything. I'm not sure. Just bear with me a second. I think that we did cover almost everything that happened in the Middle East, but there was one thing that I just wanted to look into. One second. All right. I want you to look at this one thing here. One second. All right, this might be where I could find it. Just one moment. One more second. I don't know if this is where I put my notes. Bear with me a moment. One second. No, I thought I had it, but evidently not. I don't know what I did with it. So I just don't know what I did with it. So evidently I won't be able to find it right now. So what I want to do is then just take a quick look at what's happening for tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be speaking to Shanae Williams. Shanae Williams, she is running for the first Yonkers City District, City Council District. She's going to be on with us at 10 o'clock. Then we're going to speak to, I believe we're going to be able to get a hold of Nader Sayish from 10:30 to 11. And then we're going to speak to Commissioner Clyde Isley of Mount Vernon at 11 o'clock. So another full day, that is for sure. So that's where we are at, as they say. So I want to thank you again for being with us, spending the time with us. It's really been a pleasure. Some really compelling discussions today with some candidates, so that was always good. And then we'll just move from there. So let me go back to our studio screen and just wish you a fair day and a good day till tomorrow. And we'll speak to you then. All the best. Goodbye.